thanks to Darren and the gang for driving us through the afternoon, and best of luck to Darren as she heads off on maternity leave. What an exciting adventure awaits, and to the rest of the gang as well. We'll be talking to you again soon, no doubt, and best of luck in your new roles for the next while as well. It's Thursday, the 2nd of October, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, ex-Irish internationals Keith Tracy and Maeve De Burka will join us to talk about the big night for Irish football in the Conference League, Athlone Town's title win in the Women's Premier Division, and last night's Champions League, plus today's Irish squad's naming as well. Plus, we'll have our NFL Dublin debrief with Jeff Shepherd and Shane Brennan, and Declan Quigley has big news on Irish Formula One hopeful Alex Dunn. If you want to get in touch, text us on 51552. You can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200 or we're on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, welcome along. Keith Tracy is with me in studio. It is a very busy night on the football front again, and we love these early kickoffs, some good ones as well. It is scoreless between Celtic and Sporting Braga. Roma also in action, but they are 1-0 down against Lille. 19 minutes played there. Evan Ferguson starting for Roma as well. So we'll be keeping an eye on all of those games. And of course, it is a huge night for the Irish teams in Europe as well, with Shelburne in Tallaght Stadium, and they're taking on BK Hack, and Shamrock Rovers also in action. Their way to Sparta Prague, both of those games in the Conference League group stages. We'll be talking to Keith about them, and also we will be chatting about all of the ongoing games as well. But Keith, last night's Champions League action, you got to work on the Barcelona PSG game, but no doubt keeping an eye out on a few other ones as well. Maybe Arsenal too?
Yeah, I had a little flicker over to the Arsenal result. It was a really good result for Arsenal in the end. The only English team now in the Champions League that still have a 100% record, but there's a long way to go. I'm hearing the Opta supercomputer saying Arsenal are favourites to win the Champions League and win the Premier League. I'm not of the same way of thinking, I have to be honest. But yeah, I was doing Barcelona and PSG last night. It was a brilliant game. Lamine Yamal up against Nuno Mendes, probably the best right winger in the world up against the best left winger in the world. And Nuno Mendes was a little bit sheepish sometimes trying to get after young Lamine Yamal, but when Nuno Mendes opens his legs, it was just a thing to behold. There's such athleticism from left back, and I think Hakimi, the right back for PSG, is probably the best right back in the world as well. So PSG not quite at the levels, a couple of injuries on both sides. Rafinha was missing for Barcelona, a couple of heads missing for PSG as well. So I think both teams will get stronger, but you look at PSG and you think, my God, they look really, really good.
Yeah, and it helps as well that they're a united team and have a great manager.
Exactly, yeah, and with the likes of Dembele winning the Ballon d'Or and not even being in that team, the amount of goals he brings to it, and he's a leader as well. And I looked at Ramos coming off the bench last night, and you look at him, he's not as mobile as the rest of the PSG team, but he's more of a target man, will rough people up, will be physical, and got a really good tap in. But the high line that Barcelona are playing, when you look at Hakimi and Nuno Mendes and Pacho, the PSG back line, they all have really, really quick recovery speed. Where you look at Barcelona, you think maybe one or two of them do, but not all of them. And they're literally standing on the halfway line. It's just a timing issue to get in behind. So I think every team within Europe would be looking at Barcelona thinking they can hurt you, but they can also be got at, which I think is why they're so good to watch.
OK, we'll be chatting more Champions League review in just a few minutes. But now we're turning our attention to motorsport. And there's big news today with an Irish angle. Formula 2 driver Alex Dunn announced his departure from McLaren's driver development programme. And that is with immediate effect as well. And that brings to an end his very high profile spell with the Formula 1 outfit. Huge amount of interest in this. And to bring us up to speed on why it has happened and what could happen next, motorsport journalist Declan Quigley joins us on the line. So Declan, tell us, why has this happened and where is Alex Dunn going?
Two questions that I can't actually answer with with any great certainty, Marie, but I'll give you
what's your take?
Yeah, it is a bit fascinating, isn't it? I mean, often when a driver drops out of a development program, it's announced, but there's not much of a fuss about it. This one's got lots of attention, and the likelihood is because Alex is probably going to sign somewhere else. That's the gut feeling. That's the internet speculation, and that's what I'm hearing in the paddock as well. Fundamentally, when Alex, who's just 19, remember, from Clonbillogan in Offaly, and is currently running fifth in the Formula 2 Championship at the moment, with just a couple of rounds remaining. When he signed with McLaren last May 2024, it was a saviour moment for him. He was welcomed into the papaya family, as they call it. Suddenly his car was orange. He was propelled into a competitive situation in the second half of the F3 season. Into F2, flying this year, two feature race wins, leading the championship at the halfway point, two free practices with McLaren. He was embedded in the team, absolutely part of their structure, reserve driver for Formula E, but more critically, he was part of the backroom team, helping to prepare the F1 squad ahead of their races. So, you know, all good. So why move away, or why is he being dropped, or why is he leaving? The likelihood is that he's not being dropped, that he's signed a deal elsewhere. Where is that going to be? Hot money says Red Bull. He has been in talks recently with Alpine, but he has, of course, also been seen chatting recently with Dr. Helmut Marko, the sort of rather austere Austrian sort of patriarch at the head of the Red Bull driver development program, and indeed pretty much everything in Red Bull these days. And that's always interesting because, you know, Helmut Marko has also said one or two complimentary things about Alex in the press recently. Why would he even be drawn into making a comment? It's an interesting scenario. If Alex does sign with Red Bull driver development program, what does this mean for his future? Is your next question probably?
Absolutely. And what's the trajectory?
What's the trajectory exactly? It's easy for you to say. What's going to happen? I mean, there are always four seats at Red Bull as opposed to two everywhere else. And that's part of the problem with McLaren, in that Oscar Piastri and Lando Norris look pretty much locked in with the McLaren team at the moment. 1-2 in the championship, all sweet for them. So a bit of a glass ceiling there for the McLaren driver development program. Whereas at Red Bull, it's always a revolving door, isn't there? Particularly in the seat alongside Max Verstappen. Looks like Yuki Tsunoda, who fought manfully to try and get that job and has been really badly, you know, compared badly with Verstappen, could be dropping out of Red Bull, potentially out of the Red Bull family altogether. That would leave a seat. Isaac Hadjar is in pole position to replace him, coming up from the Racing Bulls team, the B team, the satellite squad. And that would potentially leave a slot for Alex. Having said that, let's temper it slightly. Everyone wants to see Alex on the Formula One grid in 2026, but he hasn't won this F2 championship this year. He's faded a little bit in recent races for various reasons. He's down to fifth. It's going to be a real stretch for him to win that title at this point, with just two rounds remaining. And a lot of people think another season in F2 might actually be a good thing for him. Let's think about the money side of things as well. Formula 2 cars are very expensive to run. If he is taken on by Red Bull, if there's every chance that they will back him 100% and that he'll be able to stay in the game, basically. Whereas it's not thought that McLaren were paying for all of his budget. So there's lots of different considerations there. Plenty of seats open at Red Bull. Not so many opportunities in Formula One with McLaren. Also the potential for Red Bull to pay all of his budget. But therein, you know, there's also the negative. So many drivers in the past have gone through the Red Bull system. It's a bit of a meat grinder, isn't it? I mean, it takes drivers in, chews them up, spits them out. And then very often Red Bull will come and drag a driver that's not part of their program in and, you know, promote them into a place. Most recently, Sergio Perez, I suppose, the obvious example. So it's a difficult environment. Some people see it as a cold, and sometimes if you're not performing alongside Max Verstappen, then you're dropped as if you were never any good in the first place, which seems a little unreasonable as well. So there seems to be a bit of a problem with Red Bull in the way that they develop drivers sometimes, but certainly it would open up huge opportunities for him. A very exciting moment in his career, and that's always assuming that that's what's happening, because as I mentioned, he had been in conversation with the Alpine squad. But that looks like it might have gone cold in recent days, and he's edging towards Red Bull.
So for somebody who is very much in the know about this, Declan, how competitive is it and how difficult will it be for Alex Dunn to rise up through the ranks? Because I guess we always measure success when we look at the Formula One standings. Can he get there?
There are only 22 spots now. There's a new team coming in next year, Cadillac. There are only 22 spots on the grid. At any one time, you've got this conveyor belt of guys coming through karting, working their way up through Formula 4, Formula 3, Formula 2. There are other formulae as well around the world. There was talk that Alex might end up at the Japanese Super Formula Squad Championship. There's IndyCar in the States. There's so many different championships, so many drivers, you know, hugely competitive scenario. Can he make it? There's a window of opportunity there. You know, he needs to be winning. He needs to be competitive. He's hot at the moment. He is a hot name. There's no question. He's shown himself as a rookie in Formula 2 to be as fast, if not faster, than anyone else out there. He's the only guy in the top five who's won two feature races this year. So he's, you know, and has done that as a rookie. So he's really, really hot. Having said that, if he doesn't get it done in the next season into Formula 1, then there's going to be some other new hotshot that's won the Formula 3 championship, that's won the Formula 4 championship or whatever, and there'll be a lot of talk about them. So it's a weirdly fashion-orientated thing, isn't it? It's about, you know, it's hugely momentum-driven, and there's the history of motorsport is littered with stories of drivers that were absolutely brilliant, had the potential, but didn't quite make it. At the moment, Alex Dunn, I think, certainly deserves a spot in F1. Will it happen in 26? 27 looks like a really good shot for him if he gets it done in F2.
Okay, so we'll be excited, but we'll temper our expectations just a little bit. Does that sound about right?
Oh, that's the way I approach life in general. Yeah, expect the worst. And,
me too. Declan Quigley, thank you so much, as always, for that. Looking forward to keeping an eye on how Alex gets on over the next while. We're going to take a very quick break. Stay with us, though. Keith Tracy is standing by. We're going to go through that Ireland squad. We'll also be talking a bit more about Shells and Rovers, and we'll have some more discussions about the Champions League.
RTE 2 FM. Game on. Soccer.
Now, welcome back. We will be going through the Republic of Ireland squad in just a minute. But some bad news for Celtic fans. They have gone 1-0 down at home to Sporting Braga. That is not a good start, is it? Well, 31 minutes on the clock, Keith Tracy.
No, definitely not a good start. And Brendan Rodgers is already under a little bit of trouble. I'm not sure if it's Brendan Rodgers or the Celtic board. I know they're quite a cash-rich club at the minute, and the Celtic fans feel they could possibly go a little bit further in the European competitions. But to be fair for the board, I know they've got in the middle of 60-odd million there to spend. But, you know, you could go and throw 20, 25 million, 30 million at this, Marie. I don't think it guarantees any sort of success within Europe. And they generally win the SBL at a canter. They're expected to win the Scottish Cup as well. So I'm not sure how much improvement 20 to 30 million will get you. And that's why the board are thinking, I think we'll hold fire here. It's not something you would hear me agreeing with an awful lot hold, you know, not given the finances. But I think Celtic are pretty much doing exactly what they should be doing. And 20 to 30 million doesn't really improve the situation for me.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that throughout the evening. Roma also trailing. So Roma are in action against Lille, 33 minutes there, and they are trailing by a goal, 2-0. Evan Ferguson did start in that game as well. We're always so curious about Roma now because of Evan Ferguson. But he's doing well so far, Keith, isn't he?
He is doing well. His build-up play, everything that you would expect from a big, big centre-forward. I know you probably a bit of a stretch to call him a man just yet, but he's built like a man. He seems to have put on a little bit more beef. He seems to have spent more time in the gym. And I'm reading stuff coming out of Roma, and they're saying his build-up play, he's a beast of a player. They're a little bit more direct to him. Everything for Evan is going in the right direction, but he does need to start scoring goals, because you can't be a number nine for Roma if you're not scoring goals. Everything in and around, as I say, the build-up play, bringing people into the game, he's doing all that side of it. But I think we're probably looking at him through Irish eyes, thinking you're the one we need to score goals in an Irish jersey. If you're not doing that for Roma, it's a little bit of a stretch for us. But look, I do think the way Roma play, getting the ball into him early and him holding up the play and bringing people in, that would be quite similar to what he has to do for Ireland. So although he's not hitting the back of the net regularly, we can look across to Troy Parrott, and he is. So there's little bones of it, and my God, I'm already starting to, the hope is starting to creep in, Marie.
You're listening to Imre Hall Grimson. He said today he believes he can still qualify for the World Cup.
I wish I shared that enthusiasm. I mean, when you get beat by Armenia away and you've got Portugal and Hungary to come and Armenia again, I don't know where the confidence is coming from. And to be fair, you know,
he said you can't be defined by one performance.
It's not just one, though, is it? This goes way beyond Hamer's time at the helm. It's gone back into Stephen Kenny's reign, and we just don't seem able to turn over teams of a similar calibre against us. And when teams play a low block, we struggle to break them down. When teams come and have a go at us, or they play a low block, they know at some point they'll get a chance. And you know, so often we get counter-attacked on. And I'm sick to the back teeth of people telling me that we have good defenders. Yes, on paper we do have good defenders, but we don't keep clean sheets. So therefore, they aren't good defenders. And if you want to be called a good defender in my book, you've got to keep clean sheets, and we don't do that at international level. And for a team that, you know, John Egan has been picked back into the Irish team, you're looking and thinking, is he going to get into the starting 11? And think, no, because the players that are playing at the back are going to keep continuing to play. It's the middle of the pitch, it's the top end of the pitch where the problems are. And even when we look at Nathan Collins, Brentford captain, you're thinking, brilliant, that's exactly what we need. But he's not the same player when he puts on the Ireland jersey.
Okay, let's hear now from Hamer Hallgrimsson. He spoke with Tony O'Donoghue earlier today.
That is what was probably most disappointing for us was we thought the build-up was good, the preparation was good, the travel was as good as it could have been. Obviously, it was a tough game against Hungary, and then a long travel day the next day, and then one just a short session to get players active again. So it was a tricky away match always, but I think the preparation was as good as we could have done it. The reasons we could, it was probably a lot of small reasons here and there, tiredness, the pitch was not good, the heat was high, but mostly I think it was, the pitch was something that was unusual for us. We lost possession. We couldn't string together 3-4 passes before we lost the ball. So advantage to Armenia. They played there 3 days earlier, trained there before that game, and we couldn't step on the pitch the day before. So you know, it was probably that thing was unexpected that we didn't take into account and probably affected more. But like I said, we don't want to pull out excuses. It's not often that we have a game, especially a national team game, where we have 11 players playing below what they normally do. So that you can accept one or two or three players have a bad game, but this was unusual.
Does this come back again to something you mentioned before, that the shirt seems to weigh heavy on them?
We'll never know that. We never know that in the future. But obviously there was some bottleneck that we couldn't go through this game. We started the game pretty well, got two really good goal scoring chances the first 20 minutes. One saved on the line, one saved by the keeper, should have been a penalty. And goals changes games and didn't come, so probably that affected us as well.
So you've called back the experience of Seamus Coleman and John Egan. Is their leadership qualities and their experience part of the reason that you did include them in the squad this time?
No, first and foremost, football, for football reasons, picking them. But obviously missing out Robbie Brady and now Mac Doherty as well. We're lacking senior players in the squad, experience in the squad. And of course, it's good to have leaders like them coming back to the situation we are in at the moment.
If he plays, will Seamus wear the armband?
I've talked to Seamus about this. If he comes back, he's not pressing to be the captain, so... No, Nathan has done a good job, so yeah, I expect him to be the captain throughout this tournament.
You're looking at this double header. I mean, most people would expect Portugal to win the group. Going away to Lisbon is going to be difficult anyway. Is the Armenia game more the one that you're targeting, at the very least for revenge for what happened the last day?
Yeah, we need to go to Portugal and play a good game. I think to restore confidence, to restore, I'm not going to say dignity, but restore some confidence in everything and for the fans that travel to Armenia, give them a good performance in Portugal. And that's the only way we can get something out of that game, is to have a really, really good performance. Yeah, but if we look at this camp, even 3 points from this camp will keep us alive in November. And then it could be down to goal difference. So that's, again, something that we need to be aware of when we go to Portugal.
You did say afterwards that we might need a miracle. Do you believe in miracles?
I believe in miracles, yeah. But maybe after the game, it was so disappointing, maybe a strong word to use, a miracle. But if we played and everything plays well for us, I think this is absolutely doable. And I believe in this team, and I think this team should qualify for the World Cup. So, yeah, maybe a miracle is a strong word said in the aftermath of a sore loss. But no, we're still alive. We need two good performances now. And then let's see what happens in November.
So Hamer Helgrimsson there speaking to Tony O'Donoghue after he named his squad for that doubleheader. Ireland travelling to Lisbon to face Portugal on October 11th and then welcoming Armenia to Dublin 3 days later. He said they need two good performances and they're still alive, Keith.
They need a lot more than just a good performance. They've got a, I mean, there is a world where you play really well against Portugal and still lose the game because they've got a whole host of world-class players. And, you know, Hamer's talking about the travel and the training and everything being as good as it can be. We haven't even moved on to the tactical side of things yet. When we played Armenia, we just looked absolutely all over the place. And when we're behind in a World Cup qualifier, you're looking at the lads and you're thinking, right, get after them now. Try and put them under a bit of pressure. And we looked really, really leggy in the last 20 minutes against Armenia. And I know we played Hungary a couple of days before and we ended up getting the 2-2. But in 180 minutes of World Cup qualifying football, Marie, we turned up for 45 minutes. And that's the second 45 against Hungary. You can't do that at the highest level. Even the bang average teams will hurt you. And that's exactly what Armenia did. And look, this Irish team has had a lot of slack thrown at it over the last couple of years. And I don't mean this to sound harsh, but I would say it to the players' faces if I was in the dressing room. They're a fairly average bunch, but they don't work hard enough. If you're an average group, you've got to run through brick walls. You've got to be crawling off the pitch. You're that tired after the game. And our lads don't. They walk off and you think, oh, that really hurts me. We've heard this before. And some of the stuff they put on Twitter, some of the interviews they do after the game are brilliant. But I want to see them running around like it really, really means something. And people have said to me, oh, Keith, you can't say that about the Irish team. I think they've gone down a couple of levels in terms of their work rate. And again, we can start talking about tactics, but we haven't got to the basics of the game, and that's running around and outworking your opponent. I don't think we worked as hard as Armenia did. And I think if we did, our talent would come to the forefront and we'd win the game. But if you're not going to work as hard as you should...
They're not working as hard as they should for the manager. Is it the manager's fault? Should we be looking now at who can we bring in to get the best out of them? Because he's not getting the best out of them.
He's not getting the best out of them, but again...
That's his job.
It is his job, but I've heard people saying, you know, did we build up these two games too much for the Irish lads? Was it a very daunting task going into these two World Cup qualifiers? So now we have a group that we can't criticise, we can't build up big games because they just fall away under pressure, and now they're not working hard enough because they don't like the manager, or we perceive they don't like the manager. That's mental. These are professional footballers playing at the highest level there is, yet they're not willing to work hard because the manager hasn't set them up properly. We're the underdogs in everything that we do. And the Irish team I played in was a very, very talented group. There's a lot of Premier League players in it. But we worked harder than everybody else. We had a team spirit and a togetherness that seen us over the line in a lot of big games. And I don't see it with this Irish team. We seem like a bunch of individuals that turn up every now and then and we can be okay. But generally, nobody fears the Irish. And that is an awful thing to say, because the underdog mentality, it seems to have gone. It's like we're chasing the rest of Europe in this sexy style of football when we should be just concentrating on what we're good at.
OK, well, that's grim. So let's move on to the Conference League. Shells are going to make their debut in it tonight. They're hosting the Swedish side BK Häcken at Tala Stadium. When you think about how far they've came since their near collapse to be up at these echelons, it's impressive, Keith, isn't it?
Extremely impressive. Even if you were to say to me when Damien Duff walked away from Shelbourne for one reason or another, that I'd be sitting here and Shelbourne being the group stage of a Conference League, I'd have said, nah, I can't see that happening, because Damien Duff was such a big, big figure within Shelbourne. But Joey O'Brien has been largely excellent. You know, he's obviously still a novice as a manager. Don't know an awful lot about Häcken, to be honest. They're 10th in the Swedish top flight. There's only 16 teams in their league. They've got one or two dangerous players. Their stadium capacity is just over 6,000. So fairly similar to what Shelbourne are doing. But I look at Shelbourne against Häcken and I think it doesn't get a lot easier than this in the group for Shelbourne in terms of the games that they're going to play. They've got, obviously, Crystal Palace, they've got AZ Alkmaar, they've got one or two other difficult games. So Häcken at home in Tala, I know Tala's not Shelbourne's home, but it will be in Tala. And the likes of Mbeng, I think Mbeng's really done well since he's gone into the building at Shelbourne. They've only kept 2 clean sheets in the last 9 games. I think that's going to be a big one for them. I think if Shelbourne can defend like they did last year, and the one thing I do worry is they're 6th in the league at the minute, Shelbourne. They're only 5 points off second place in the domestic league. So they're sort of straight down the middle. Do we chase the European race within the domestic league, or do we go all out? And, you know, I was doing a bit of research earlier, and a victory in a group stage pays 400,000. A draw pays 1,000. 133,000 for a draw. So a couple of wins in this could be absolutely brilliant for Shelbourne. And like I say, I think against Hacken, they've half a chance.
And what about Shamrock Rovers then away to Sparta Prague?
This is definitely more difficult toy. Sparta Prague are comfortable at this level. They're forced in the Czech Republic top flight. They've played 5 home games in the league so far. They've won all 5. They've scored 8 goals in the last 2. They've got a whole host of internationals. They've got Kosovo, Serbians, Ecuador, Czech Republic, Finnish internationals. And generally, I'd be looking at this and thinking Sparta Prague don't get turned over a lot in Prague. And you'd be thinking Shamrock Rovers do well to get anything there. But Shamrock Rovers, unbeaten in the last 10. They've 7 wins and 3 draws. The likes of Josh Honahan's been in and around the Irish squad. Lopez is a Cape Verde international. Graham Bourke is a full Irish international. Ed McGinty has come to the party in terms of making some really big saves. And Rovers have scored 53 goals this season. They make an awful lot of chances. And in Europe, Shamrock Rovers have become an awful lot better out of possession. They don't really get tested like that within the League of Ireland in terms of being out of possession, but they've become an awful lot better. And although I expect it to be really difficult and a point would be a bonus for Shamrock Rovers, I think they've earned the right not to be written off in this game. And yeah, I think Rovers might get something, although it'll be bumpy along the way.
Yeah, they have a very experienced manager as well in Stephen Bradley, who will be well equipped to deal with an occasion like this evening.
Yeah, of course. And a lot of the Shamrock Rovers players have been around, as I said. Graham Bourke is a full Irish international. Pico Lopez is a Cape Verde international. Josh Honan is trained with the Irish Force team. So they've all been in and around. Ed McGinty's been across the water as well for a couple of stints. They've played in big games. They know what this feels like. And going away to Sparta Prague, I was watching Stephen Bradley doing his interview beforehand in the stadium in the background. It looks brilliant. Yeah, The facts and everything else, the stats would look and you think Sparta Prague should win that. I have a sneaky feeling Shamrock Rovers might give us a little upset there.
Yeah, well, the stats and the facts wouldn't have suggested that we'd have 2 teams at this stage.
Exactly.
But there we are. We will be going to Talla Stadium to check in with John Kenny for that Shells Hacking game a little bit later on. We'll also have more from Keith Tracy. We'll be talking to Maeve de Burka as well about that Lone Town winning the Women's Premier Division. All that will be coming up after we have a debrief on all that happened from an NFL perspective in Dublin last weekend.
This is 2FM Game On. Eye on America.
But he comes here in his 21st season, first one with the Steelers. And coming off a 6-for-6 drive, he'll throw to begin this drive, and it's DK Metcalf. He's in the loose. There goes DK. A block from Austin inside the 5.
The atmosphere was outstanding. I mean, I came out real early, and in most NFL stadiums, there's like a 2 hours when the stadium opens and it starts to trickle in. But somebody came back in the locker room at like 11 and goes, "Man, there's a ton of people out there already." I was like, "Well, we're not in the States anymore. You know, this is a different type of fan." So I loved it. I thought the crowd was fantastic. There's a lot of terrible towels there, but I felt like there was probably some good old Irish get in the mix too, you know, waving those towels around a little bit. The music was great. The fans were cool. I mean, the field was pristine. Thought the field was really, really good. Conditions were good. We had a nice, sunny Irish day, right? I feel like a normal Irish Scottish day is like overcast and drizzling. This was extra, extra nice today. So the whole experience was fantastic. Shout out to the country and everybody who made this happen. Win or lose, I would have said the same thing. I just felt like the reception from the people here was outstanding.
All right, do you think Dublin has done enough to deserve another NFL game in the future?
100%. Yes. I mean, I'm not going to share exactly what he said last night, but I thought it was definitely impactful Coach T talked about his relationship with the late, great Ambassador Rooney and how much he meant to him and how much Ambassador Rooney loved football, loved the guys, and loved his appointment here in Ireland. And, you know, me personally, I'm a little older, so I appreciate the history. There was a lot of us that wanted to win it a little bit more for the family, knowing how much affection they have for this area. So I enjoyed that talk last night from Coach T. And again, I really enjoyed everything that we experienced here. It was a short trip, but from the moment we landed, the security guys over at the Carlton House were hilarious. And the Guinness was good in downtown Dublin. And it would be a nice flight back with hopefully a yearly return by, you know, us or two other teams. Yeah, we're going to go over to Dublin, hit some pubs, and then and take off.
Two more.
No, we're going straight back.
That was Aaron Rodgers saying all the right things after Ireland hosted their first regular season NFL game with the Steelers beating the Vikings in Croke Park over the weekend. And now that the dust has settled on everything that went with it, it's time for a bit of a debrief. And I'm delighted to say that our regular American football analyst Jeff Shepherd is with us on the line, as is Shane Brennan of the Irish Indo, who is an all-round NFL expert. You're both very, very welcome. Shane, you were there. You were part of it, pretty much. How was it? Was it as good as everybody says it was?
I would say it's probably better than everybody said it was, because for me and for most of us who are enthusiasts of American football, Dublin was Disneyland pretty much from Thursday onwards with everything that was happening. But the surprising thing for me is, like, I've been to international games all around, you know, London and Germany when they've come to a city, but they've never necessarily taken over a town and really brought the atmosphere until you're kind of within a mile of the stadium. Dublin was really embraced the Pittsburgh Steelers culture from early on. I mean, you heard Aaron Rodgers there talk about the fact that the head coach gave a sort of very inspired speech to all of his players, because, of course, the links between the Steelers and Ireland. And you felt that, because I think there's a lot of Steelers fans coming in from America, from Germany, from all around Ireland, and all sort of hanging out together. They really created a fantastic atmosphere around Croke Park from around 11 o'clock in the morning. This was a 2:30 kickoff, and there was a place buzzing pretty much from early on. And then, of course, the fact that we got a pretty good game between two teams who made the playoffs last year, it ended up being quite a close contest, one that's really important in the context of the Steelers season. I mean, it positives all around, I think, for this one, except for the Vikings, who obviously went away not winning the game. But from every other standpoint, it was pretty fun weekend.
So, Jeff Shepherd, it went down brilliantly here in Ireland. How did it go down stateside?
I think it was evident how excited people were to have this game happening, and I think that just kind of carried over on television. You know, we talked about it last week on my, you know, the Thursday slot. You know, the weekend was going to be kicking off like later that afternoon, and to Shane's point, I mean, it was all over the city, and really, you know, the NFL had done a good job of visiting, you know, all the counties across the country ahead of time to kind of build, you know, some hype for the game as well. So it wasn't just a Dublin affair. I mean, they really wanted it, you know, to be, you know, across all of Ireland that people were buying into it. Again, the NFL did a phenomenal job of having it be the Steelers. I'm not saying it wouldn't have worked if it was involving another team, but just those ties with the Rooneys and, you know, just Steeler Nation is not just across America. It is apparently worldwide. Patrick Queen, the middle linebacker, talked about how he felt like they were at Heinz Field. I mean, they knew the cheers, they knew the songs, the terrible towels were all over the place. There was a giant terrible towel unveiled in the stands before the game. So the Steelers really, it's really hard to recreate that home game atmosphere in those international games. And I think a lot of the Steelers players felt like that was recreated.
And another positive, Shep, as well, was just the figures. So the international audience was massive, 7.9 million US viewers. So it became the second most watched international game on the NFL network. That's a huge success.
That's a giant success, Marie, because when you think about just the time zones, I mean, the one that I'm in, the game kicks off at 8:30 on a Sunday morning. Okay, that's pretty normal. But, I mean, you know, out on the West Coast, California, Los Angeles, San Francisco, these big NFL media markets, it's 6:30 in the morning you're having to wake up to watch a football game. And people were doing it. So, I mean, that's a tremendous number. Again, I think all of the boxes were checked. They asked Aaron Rodgers, do you think Dublin's done enough to earn a second game? And he answered, you know, unequivocally, absolutely. And I think every metric that you could potentially use bears that out.
Yeah, very much so. And Shane, what do you think now is going to come next? Because a lot of the narrative pre-game and post-game was about whether or not it's going to be a regular thing in Dublin that we are going to get these NFL games. What do you think?
I think the possibility of the NFL returning to Dublin isn't a case of if, but when. I think the biggest question is whether it's going to happen next year or whether we have to wait another 2 or 3 years for it to come back. I was speaking to a marketing officer for the Kansas City Chiefs who said that they are keen to play here in 2026. Now, that's not necessarily their decision. There's many other stakeholders in that. The Irish government and the NFL, UK and Ireland, are keen for this to become a regular thing, although they didn't really put any specifics on this. I mean, to Shai's point, obviously, the Steelers coming over here meant that they brought a large crowd. It was an unusually large American crowd for an international game who came over to Dublin. It was as opposed to a London game where the majority of the people who are watching a game in London are from either the UK or Europe. So it might be a little bit trickier to find another fan base who are willing to travel in these big numbers. That's not saying that the NFL couldn't sell out Croke Park just purely with the Irish demand, but in terms of trying to recreate that sort of real sort of sense of home atmosphere, because, I mean, Croke Park felt as authentically Irish as authentically Pittsburgh on Sunday. That was a really, really rare thing to match and a fantastic thing to try and recreate. It wouldn't surprise me if the next game was potentially a Steelers home game in 2027, but I think there will be a lot of pressure. If the NFL are serious about pushing their playing more games internationally, and, you know, Roger Goodell said over the weekend, including in the Sunday Independent, that he wants to see the NFL playing 16 international games every year. They're playing 7 this year across 5 countries. Then they're not going to wait a year or 2 years before they come back into America where they've had a really successful first run. So, look, we won't get any proper details on this until about November, December, I'd say, by the time all the current slate of international games are done, the last one being played in Spain in November. But it wouldn't surprise me if we see a lot of teams, the Green Bay Packers, for instance, who have 2 Irishmen on their roster, trying to find a way to come and play in Dublin next year.
Yeah, Shep, there probably are a few teams, all right, that could make a mark here. And Shane mentioned the Chiefs there. They were in Brazil. They definitely have an appetite for travel. Could you see them coming to Dublin?
Yeah, and you know, to Shane's point, I mean, the Chiefs have already vocalized the fact that they want to come and play in Dublin. You know, another team that could replicate what the Steelers did would be the Dallas Cowboys. You know, they've kind of got that across America and probably, you know, I'd say some international fan base as well, just because of the success they had in the 70s and then again in the 90s. I think the Packers could potentially do it. As Shane said, the Chiefs are willing to do it. You know, there's the Dublin aspect. Some other places that they've not played games yet, you know, in Paris, you know, the New Orleans Saints are a kind of an easy fit there because of the French history in the city of New Orleans. And so, there are markets that, you know, you don't want to go back to some places where maybe it's not well attended or it's hard to sell tickets. It was not difficult at all to sell tickets and to get eyeballs on televisions for this Dublin game. And that is the thing that the NFL is looking for.
Shep, is it fair on the fans, though, the fact that they are moving these regular games so far away? And if you're committed and you want to go, it's going to cost you a lot of money.
It does, yeah. I mean, look, I'm a Saints season ticket holder, and I mean, I can't tell you we could just jump on a plane and fly over to Paris or fly over to Dublin. It's a little easier for me with Dublin because I probably have a free place to stay with some people. But, you know, if I've got to go to Paris and get hotels for 4 or 5 nights, it becomes an expensive trip. That is the kind of the balancing act that the NFL has to do each year with the teams. Now, the Jacksonville Jaguars, you know, many years ago, they raised their hands and they said, look, there's going to be an expansion of the NFL. We want to be the team that London cheers for. So, you know, they've played, you know, the most international games because they've played at least one game a year for the last couple of years in London. You're right. It's not fair for, you know, a team fan base to lose a home game that you have to pay for these tickets every single year. But that is something that the NFL is going to have to kind of balance.
Shane, what about London, though? The popularity has waned a little bit. Is that a concern? And why do you think it isn't as much of a hit as it was when the games were first there?
I think three things with London, I think. Firstly, the ticket prices have gone up than they were even 3 or 4 years ago. Now, and obviously, you know, the higher price you get, there will be a lot of people who may not necessarily be fans of the two teams who are playing on field, who decide, well, I'm not going to pay whatever it is, £200 sterling to watch two teams I'm not particularly interested in. I'd rather stay at home. Secondly, because the NFL are playing more games around Europe, that Irish fans, if they wanted to see an NFL game, they don't need to fly to London. They could have seen it in Dublin this year. I mean, Germany is probably the biggest American football fan base in Europe. You actually go to games in London, there's a significant amount of German fans, as there was the week just gone in Dublin. The Germany has hosted a game every year. They hosted two games a couple of years ago. So, like, there's 70,000 people who are going to be in Berlin in November who might have previously decided, you know, pre-pandemic, when it was just London hosting games, that they would have flown there. And thirdly, and I'm trying to be as fair as I can about this, knowing that we're looking ahead to a battle between the Cleveland Browns and the Minnesota Vikings this weekend, but the teams that are coming over and aren't necessarily the really big drivers that people really, really want to see. I think everybody wants to see the Steelers. We want to see teams that are playing well. So, like, everyone wants to see Patrick Mahomes. Everybody wants to see Joe Burrow if he was fit. I'm not quite sure everyone's lining up to see the Cleveland Browns. And the Vikings do have a big fan base. They will, like, I think we're expecting about 60% of the fans who are going to be in Tottenham Stadium this coming Sunday to be Vikings fans. There's a lot of Vikings fans across England in particular. But I think that is affecting things. I mean, the next game is playing in London is between the Jets and the Broncos. I'm looking forward to being there. As I'll be showing it, obviously the connection between New York and these islands is very strong, but the Jets aren't a very good team. There might be a lot of neutrals who might decide, you know what, there isn't enough star power for me to go and watch this. But just because it's waning, that doesn't mean it still isn't a hugely exciting thing. A lot of people are buying into it. But in terms of where the momentum has gone, there probably isn't as much momentum around the London game specifically than there used to be, because the momentum has gone elsewhere, because there's a first ever game in Ireland this year. There's going to be a first ever game in Spain this year as well. So Spanish fans, you know, don't need to go to London to watch it. They could save up and go to Madrid to watch the Dolphins play the Commanders instead. So it's one of those things that, because London used to be the only epicenter for American football in Europe, it had all the momentum, and that momentum is spreading out. It's sort of a consequence of expansion elsewhere.
So, Shane, are you going to all of the European games?
No, unfortunately, I'm not going this weekend. So on the Irish NFL show, we've kind of split it up. So I will not be at the one this weekend. I will be going to Jets Broncos. And I'm going to Berlin as well, a city nice. I've never been to before. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, great stuff. Okay, we'll be back to our regular review preview of the NFL. But we wanted to have a very special chat about all that went down in Dublin at the weekend. So to Jeff Shepherd, thank you as always. We'll talk to you next week. And Shane Brennan of the Irish Independent and the Irish NFL show. Thank you guys so much.
Game on. Eye on America. Game on. Soccer.
Now, welcome back. In the Europa League, Celtic are still 1-0 down against Sporting Braga, and Roma are still 1-0 down against Lille as well. Lots of other games underway too, and more starting at 8 o'clock. We'll also be keeping an eye or checking in Tala Stadium with John Kenny ahead of the Shelburne game, and hopefully we'll have some team news and some team news from Shamrock Rovers as well. But now we are turning our attention to women's football, and at Lone Town's Heroics, they are now back-to-back Women's Premier Division champions, and Maeve de Burka joins us on the line. Maeve, it was probably never in doubt, really, was it, their 4-0 victory over Cork City, but what a season they've had. Despite all of the upheaval, they have managed to go and get the job done, and they're not done yet, really, are they?
No, they're not exactly. Heading for the double, or trying to do that anyway, with the FAI Cup final to come in a few weeks. So yeah, it was, like you said, a bit of a routine victory, I suppose, last night against Cork. They won 4-0 down there. And yeah, the Kayleigh Shine, who's probably the only local girl really in the starting 11, got the first goal. And then Kelly Brady, who's the top scorer in the league at the moment, got a hat-trick as well. So yeah, they didn't make, or they, it was very professional performance, I suppose, from them. And yeah, they'll be looking now to see if they can do the double, because of course they weren't able to do that last year. They were just league winners last year.
Yeah, they'll be trying to take that one step further. So what is it about this Athlone Town team that is so fierce?
I think for me, the thing that stands out really is actually the defence. Usually it's the attackers who take the headlines, but they've only conceded 9 goals in the 20 games so far this season. So they're really, really solid at the back. They've a couple of great keepers, one from the US and one from Greece as well. And really consistent kind of back four too. A couple of Gallaghers in there, Kelly Brennan and Shauna Brennan too. So yeah, they've been really good. And then like that, they've just firepower the likes of Kelly Brady, Maddie Gibson as well. And Roisin Malloy too on the wing. They're really talented players, so I think they've been unstoppable in that sense.
How much credit will their manager John Sullivan get? He did take over only just a little while ago when their own manager departed for reasons that I suppose will all really come to light in time. But John Sullivan seems to have been able to steer them to that league win. But will he get much credit for it, or were they going to do it anyway?
Hard to tell. They're well set up, in fairness. The team who hasn't, like I said, lost all season in the league. So yeah, I think they kept, it was kind of a case of more of the same, but in fairness to them, something like that could have the ability to kind of deter them or put them off track, but they kept it going. And whether that's credit to John Sullivan or to the girls themselves, we don't know, looking on from the outside. But Gordon Brett has been in there as well for the whole season too as assistant, so I'm sure he brought some kind of continuity as well and stability to them too.
Yeah, because they did have a good opponent there in Shells chasing them down.
Yeah, they did. Shells are, I suppose, they're guaranteed now to finish second. And I think what really kind of tested them was probably their injuries. Their squad depth was tested a bit more than they would have wanted. So, yeah, they'll be disappointed only finishing second because their standards have been so high. They won the FAI Cup last year as well. So no silverware for Shells this season. But yeah, I'm sure they'll be looking to push on because they've got a lot of young talent coming through as well there.
Yeah, and in contrast then, Athlone Town do have a lot of players from abroad. Is this a good thing or a bad thing, do you reckon?
Hard to tell, really. I suppose there's kind of, you could look at it from both sides, and that definitely they would raise the standards or make it more competitive across, even within Athlone, but then also across the league as well, I think. But then there's a lot of downsides too, probably limited player opportunities for local players, really, if the players from abroad are taking those spaces. And of course the cost, you have to look at it, whether in terms of visas, work permits, all that, as well as the cost of paying the players too. So from a kind of long-term or medium-term thing, you'd wonder if it's sustainable to bring in, like, only 4 of the starting team last night were from Ireland. So I think probably you need to look at the balance, maybe get a strong kind of foundation of local players really, and then complement that with the foreign-based players coming in as well to, like I said, increase the standard.
Okay, Maeve de Burka, as always, thank you so much for all of that, and congratulations to Athlone Town on their big victory. We are going to head now to Tallaght Stadium. John Kenny is there for us ahead of this huge game for Shelburne. Any team news, John Kenny?
Yeah, we got some news for you, right? And history tonight, Sean Gannon starts tonight for Shelburne, equals Ronan Finn's record of 63 European games. Sam Bona's out, so Gannon comes in, what looks like a back three for the veteran and former Shamrock Rovers player, in fact Dundalk player as well, won a lot of titles down the years, so he's starting tonight. Wessel Spiel of the Netherlands starts in goal for long-term injury Conor Kearns, and that's the team news we have for the moment. Not the most pleasant of evenings, there's wind whipping across the ground from the Dublin Mountains away to our right-hand side. The rain thankfully has stopped for the moment, but it wouldn't be guaranteed that it will stop right throughout the game. History made tonight. Both Shelburne and Shamrock Rovers qualifying for group stage of a European competition. Shells in Tallaght as Talca Park isn't suitable to host games like this, facing Häcken of Sweden, who are actually struggling in the Swedish league at present, but who beat the likes of Anderlecht of Belgium in one of the qualifying ties, a side that have played previously in the Champions League. So they cannot be taken lightly by a Shell side that are still battling themselves domestically to get a place in Europe next season. Tonight's game is one of 6 games Shells will play in the Conference League. It also includes the likes of AZ Alkmaar and Crystal Palace, who are currently in action in another match in the Conference League. A win tonight against Häcken would be a huge start for Shelburne, but I'd say Shells will take a draw this evening, especially given the weather conditions here in Tallaght. It's an 8 o'clock kickoff here, Marie.
Great stuff. Thank you so much for that, John. Kenny, Keith, any Shamrock Rovers team news before we head off?
Yeah, the Shamrock Rovers team is just in. It's Ed McGinn Conte in goal, a back three of Dan Cleary, Roberto Lopez, Corey O'Sullivan, a midfield five of Honahan, Healy, Nugent, McGovern and McAniff, and up front Rory Gaffney and Danny Grant.
Okay, give me a prediction for the two games. Will we have two Irish victories?
Yeah, I'm going to go really, really big with this one. Loads of confidence. I think Shamrock Rovers will win and Shells will get a draw.
Great stuff. Keith, thank you so much. Ronan Lawler produced. Our broadcast coordinator was Stephen Higgins. Shane will be back here tomorrow from 6 o'clock to preview the weekend's sporting action. Up next here on 2FM, it's the new music show.